Blog Talk Radio.
From Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, truly the sun and fun capital of the world and a great place to be tonight. I'm Dr. John Stamey, and I want to welcome everybody to the one and only ScaryCast, where we have some really great guests and just so excited to have everyone here tonight. We've got a full house. We've got a lot of the ScaryCasters are here with us. We've got a great guest. So first of all, I want to introduce from the creepiest town that I'm actually the creepiest town in Georgia, the one and only Chris Chastain and a Bigfoot habituator. How are you doing tonight, Chris?
I'm doing awesome, John. Glad to be here. And like I always say, my favorite night, well, one of two of my favorite nights of the week. So excited about tonight's show.
Well, we are glad to have you here, and thank you very much. And from Houston, Texas, that supreme orator and the guy that can speak so well, and we're so glad to have him, Kyler Smith. How are you doing tonight?
I just realized I was muted. I'm doing good. Glad to be back.
We're glad you're here. That's right. And just keep it coming because you guys are the best. You really are. And now, the newest, but not the most insignificant, the official senior inventor of ScaryCast, who's got several United States patents and works very hard creating interesting things for people, the one and only, and with a PhD from Albert Schweitzer University, the one and only Dr. Brad Mulder. How are you doing tonight?
I cannot complain. Doing my thing, building machines, and I want to give a great big shout-out to our guest tonight because every Tuesday night between 10 and 12 Eastern time, I am building machines while I'm listening to Strange World with Mark Sargent and Karen B., one of my favorite shows of the week.
Well, that's a great shout-out, and that's a great lead-in to our guest tonight. So excited to have him. He's one of the best versed people in his topic, and he's always a lot of fun to have, and just so glad to have him. So Mark Sargent from he is a flat earth advocate, and we're so glad to have you here, Mark. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me on again. We've done this a few times now, so that's great.
We have, and it's a lot of fun. You're entertaining. You have a great command of your subject, and that's what I'm looking for in guests, is someone that has a really great command. Now, speaking of a command, I got a compliment today from I was on the Pork and Beans show, and I don't know if you all know about that. They got about probably 2,500 listeners every week, and they're really good guys, and I'd always wanted to be on there. And Robin McRae, thank you very much. The Queen of ScaryCast got me on there. We had a blast. I mean, it was just incredible. So I'm going to be putting a link up to the Pork and Beans show for this week as soon as they give it to me tomorrow. But it was a lot of fun. It was great. Those guys are awesome. And Michael, who is actually Michael Beans, of Pork and Beans, he's actually going to be a speaker at the Flying Saucer Comic-Con September 16th in Burnsville, North Carolina, produced by ScaryCast and a whole bunch of other fun people. And so that's going to be a blast. I think Dr. Mulder is going to be there. I think Chris Chastain will be there. And I know I will be there. I'll be trying to, like, get that thing running. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Can't wait to see everybody there. So anyway, Mark Sargent,
yeah,
Here's what we did. Let me tell you what I kind of figured out. I found a couple of really good websites about the flat earth. And I'm going to tell you something. These boys that have put together these websites have worked hard to produce some very good, very solid evidence about the flat earth. And the one that I found was flatearthlogic.net. It's a really good site, and I recommend it for people. So what I've done is I've asked our Scarycasters to look over a particular topic and ask you some questions. Now, they don't have to do that. They're free, of course. We don't micromanage our co-hosts. They can ask you whatever they want. But I'll tell you what, it had some good material, and it gave me some food for thought, and I came up with some interesting things. So first of all, Chris,
yeah,
Chastain, you got a question for the man, no myth, no, he is a legend, Mark Sargent. You got a question for him?
Well, starting right out the gate, it's not so much a question, but or maybe it could be. So I was watching video today on flat earth and how the seasons are impacted with with the theory that the earth is tilted in a certain direction and
yeah,
in the position of the sun, and everything, it all seems extremely backwards as far as, you know, if the earth is tilted to a certain direction toward the sun, then, you know, where it's hot, you know, we
right,
should all be sharing that, you know, at the same time, as opposed to, you know, part of the earth is colder and part of the earth is warmer. So, I'll be the first to admit, I don't understand all the details surrounding it.
Right.
But it was kind of like, how is that possible then? You know, based on kind of how we're taught in school, I don't know, maybe you can shed some extra light on that. That's what caught my attention.
Yeah, when it comes to what we're taught in school, in fact, I made a video on this some years ago called The Code of Credibility. And
uh-huh,
I didn't mention this, but I'll mention it for this show. I put this a quote in the body of the description box of every single video I make. It's from George Orwell, you know, the guy that did 1984. And he wrote this piece back in the mid-1940s, and he was talking about how people believe in science no matter what they tell them, right? You know, if you wear a lab coat, you instantly have more credibility. And he was talking – he said, you know, if you walk around and on the street and you ask people – and he was not a flat earther, but I'd like to preface that. And he goes – and you ask them how they know the world is a globe. They look at you kind of funny, and they'll say, what are you talking about? We know. We know it's a globe. And it's like, really? How do you know? Now, he wrote this in 1946, what he was getting at was people's heads, the gears started grinding, because you realize, especially in 1946, it's not that they knew, that they were told. There was no space program in 1946. So how did everybody – remember, NASA came along, and they were just reinforcing something that had been taught to us for generations and generations. You know, a globe model that had been put out there for five centuries, so your father and his father before him, and, you know, going back farther than you can probably track your family tree. So how did we know? There's a big difference between knowing and actually figuring it out for yourself. So, again, when NASA came along, it's like, oh, look, we went to the moon. You know, they were reinforcing the globe model. But in doing so, like with the seasons, segue back into that, you know, they tell you it's like, well, they have to come up with answers for things. We'll use the seasons, but I'll transition into gravity really quick, which is with the seasons. It's like, well, it's obvious because the earth is on a tilt. that, you know, the sun, you know, that's the reason, you know, the sun is actually getting, you know, a little bit more rays, you know, on the ground. It's like, well, and the temperature rises a certain point. It's like, really, you know, even though we're in an elliptical orbit around the sun sometimes, and you're saying that, you know, it, we're in this perfect Goldilocks zone, right? Where the sun, yeah, it actually goes up and down, you know, double-digit degrees, mm-hmm. depending on the tilt of the Earth. It's like, wow, that's fascinating. But they only put that in there because that's the only answer they could come up with. It's like, if it's the only answer that was remotely plausible to them, transition that over to gravity, for example. You can ask any scientist right now, and they will say, we can't tell you what gravity is. We can only tell you what it does. We can only tell you the symptoms of gravity. You drop something, you know, from your desk, it falls to the ground. That's got to be gravity. Mm-hmm. And you say, okay, well, what is it? It's like, well, we don't know because we can't reproduce it artificially.
And it's just a theory, and right?
It's absolutely just a theory. Every scientist will admit this. And they'll say, you know, the short version is, well, it's a magical molecular force that pulls things down to the center of a ball. And I'm one of those flat earthers that actually believes in gravity to a certain extent, although I do believe in density, for example, which is that, you know, if you guys know what density is, lighter things fall, you know, get pushed up towards the top. You've probably seen the fluids chart, you know, where you can pour a whole bunch of different fluids into a jar and they'll separate based on density. Or you take a helium balloon, you let it go, you know, it's going to go up and up and up. Why? Because of gravity? You know, because it's beating gravity, and then it gets to space, and then what happens? You know, where's the bleeding edge of space?
Hey, Mark, I've got to say something because I saw a little meme today about a helium balloon going up, and someone looked and said, "Is that anti-gravity?" I thought,
sure. I'll take one even. We'll make the density one even easier for you guys to understand. We've all done it in a pool, whether it's a beach ball or a volleyball or a football, anything with pressure on it. You hold it underwater, you let it go. What? It just pops back up to the top of the pool you're in. Well, did that ball pop up because it was defying gravity, or just because it was trying to escape the heavier density that was surrounding it? And anyway, the short version is that science makes massive assumptions and puts their stamp on it because it's repeatable, even though they can't explain it. They cannot explain gravity. Again, they can. I'll give you one more real quick. And I ramble, so please feel free to cut me off. There's articles out there about they don't know exactly how planes stay in the air. For example, we all know, if you guys know anything about aerodynamics or fluid dynamics, air travels faster, not just over a curved surface, right? Over the top of a curved surface,
right.
And, you know, creating lift, which is why cars, when they get about 100, or even boats, when you get about 150 miles an hour, cars are basically weightless because there's so much lift underneath that car. The tires are barely touching the road, right? Well, you do that and you can use that to fly a plane. Then you come back to the engineers and you say, so why does air travel faster over the top of a curved surface? They don't know. It just does. And because of that, the plane takes off and lands, it's like, well, you know what, we're not going to worry about it. It's absolutely repeatable. It happens all the time. So therefore, it's science. And they use it with all sorts of things. You know, even my favorite, I don't know if I talked about it last time, the double slit experiment. Double slit experiment is akin to magic or a virtual reality. Take your pick. But it's absolutely repeatable. Therefore, science is like, nope, it's one of ours. It's under our umbrella. It's like, all right, I see what you guys are doing. Anyway, sorry, that's my little ramble.
No, that's fine, and I'm glad you said it. You brought up some very important points that I am aware of, and so I mean I don't know what to say, especially like the fact that air travels faster over a curved surface. I don't think that's actually the case. I think that you have a curved surface where you have a little bit more resistance at the beginning in terms of, you know, flying. You have a little more resistance, but then after that, it vanishes. Therefore, the resistance goes away. Now, I mean, you know, maybe that's not the world's greatest explanation, but I have always thought that, yes, it does travel faster over a curved surface, but maybe not necessarily. It travels very quickly when there's no resistance. And right. So anyway, that just, you know, I'll just – I'll just leave it at that. And if anybody wants to know, contact me, send me a message, Scarycast, and I'll draw you a little example. But you know, I think it is very interesting.
Can I address the how Seasons work on Flat Earth video from the flatearthlogic.net?
Please.
It's a pretty good video, and actually it's an older video. We've got much more updated stuff on the app that we've got out there, the Flat Earth Sun, Moon, and Zodiac Clock app, which is really, really great. It's got some fantastic graphics. In fact, you can see everything that's in the Seasons work thing in real time on the app. It is, in one sense, it works absolutely perfectly in that if the sun is very, very tiny, you know, less than 70 miles wide, give or take, and it moves like a mobile around a child's crib or a needle on a record player where it's not following the same path on any given day, which is why, you know, you can get longer and shorter days as it gets shorter. That works absolutely fantastic, except it's also the weakest part of the flat earth argument, which is, if that is the case, there cannot be just one light source, because while you can do 24-hour sun at the North Pole, because the remember the flat earth map, the center of the map would be the peg of the record player, then how do you get 24-hour sun on the edge of the record? You can't do it, not just with just one light source, which leads us to believe there's either more than one light source or that Antarctica is not getting the absolutely bankable 24-hour sun that they say it happens sometimes. I've seen arguments for both, but either way, you know, it's by far, I like being as transparent as possible. It's the weakest argument in the flat earth in that I just have to throw up my hands like, I don't know. I don't know what's happening in Antarctica because nobody could go there. Thank God for the Antarctic Treaty, which forbids anybody from going there, and no one, you know, can set up shop there at least for another 20 years, and then they'll kick the can down the road. So there you go. There's my addendum.
We'll see what happens. Yeah. And just so that everybody knows, in 1957, we had the International Geophysical Year. So they brought scientists and statesmen down to Antarctica, and they obviously were told some things, and everybody came back and kept their mouths shut. Mark Sargent, am I correct?
Yes. Yeah, Antarctica is a mystery, and because of how this world was designed, and we'll just say by God, it was designed very, very well. The Antarctica, as just from face value, just screams go away. You know, you have icebergs before you get to the coastline. The coastline is more or less a Game of Thrones wall that goes up 150 feet, and then most of the continent sits at 14,000 feet. A lot of people don't know that. It's very unusual. Meaning, you know, altitude sickness kicks in at half that, at like 7,000 feet. So there's no animal life. There's no plant life. I mean, yeah, there's some penguins here and there. But you have to bring your resources with you. I mean, it's an exploration nightmare. There's hardly any markers out there. And when they figured out that this was the beginning of the end of the world, you know, the edge, as it were, you know, somewhere off in the distance is the edge of this snow globe, they sealed it off, which is exactly what I would have done. And they did it in the same year they announced their Van Allen radiation belt, in 1959. They said, oh, yeah, by the way, Van Allen belt up above you, super, super deadly. No one should ever go through it. Kennedy screwed that up the very next year, but we'll talk about that later. And then in 1959, they announced the Antarctic Treaty, the only unbroken treaty in the history of the world, which said that no corporation, no matter how many liquid assets you have, no matter how much political clout you have, can set up shop in Antarctica. And remember, this was 1959. They said it's not even up for review until 2041, which is close, fairly close now, but not back in 1959. I mean, tell me another treaty. It's like, oh yeah, we'll review the treaty in 80 years. It's like, what are you talking about? And again, it goes against the reason why. Sorry, go ahead.
Is there any treaty that has never been broken other than the Antarctic Treaty? I don't believe so.
I don't believe so. Everything's either been broken or revised to the point where it might as well have been broken, you know, where they've changed the rules. I mean, no one – in fact, not only are you not allowed to, you know, to go against this treaty, you're not even allowed to protest it. That's the other part. There are countries that would love to get their hands on the resources. I mean, our Navy guy, Admiral Richard Byrd, he went down there and then went on television and said, oh, there's oil and gas and coal and uranium. There's all sorts. He goes, we're going to be fighting over this for the next 100 years. And then a couple of years later, they just locked the whole thing up with a big padlock I said, nope, nobody goes down there. It's like, find me a place where the oil and gas industry, you guys know what I'm talking about, where the oil and gas industry can't get in. I mean, they've got gobs of liquid cash. They can start fracking in your neighbor's backyard tomorrow if they wanted to. And yet these same companies aren't even allowed to talk about Antarctica, not even allowed to bring it up. They, you know, forget about full-page ads, you know, that you could run in newspapers. I mean, British Petroleum, every country would have a vested interest, but they all sign off on this treaty. When you become an economic power, you sign off on it and say, yeah, you can't go down there. Okay. It goes against everything that we know about capitalism. You know, there should be wars. There should be militaries that have already fought battles down there over this place. And yet, nope, I think 5,000 people at any given time are down there. You know, mostly military,
something
military
like
scientists.
That.
The what?
It's just crazy. It's just crazy. Yeah. And nobody talks
and
about it. I'll say this, and everybody can laugh, but there's actually one movie. There are actually two movies about, no, there's only one, Thing from Another World. Takes place in Antarctica.
Oh, right.
Did you know that?
The original, you know, and the Kurt Russell remake, and then, you know, they did the Mary Elizabeth Winstead remake about 25 years after that. I don't know if they ever actually shot in Antarctica. I could probably look that up. But yes,
I'm sure they didn't. But that's the only movie that was, I believe, and check me. I mean, you know, you guys are smart. Check me if I'm wrong, but I think that is the only movie set in Antarctica. And the Kurt Russell version, I mean, well, of course, we love the original Thing from Another World, starring James Arness as the Thing. Yeah, Matt Dillon it was an incredible film for its time, 1953. But then the Kurt Russell movie, the way that it ended is one of the most unbelievable films. It was a great film. It should have been nominated for an Academy Award. And it's like, hell no, it was science fiction. And then The Shape of Water then wins an Academy Award. Everybody knows The Shape of Water? It's a crazy film. It's actually a very brilliant film. But it finally broke the ice, and The Shining didn't even win an Academy Award. You know, probably the greatest horror film ever made. And you know, just that's how Hollywood. You know, all the liberals out there don't want to give an Academy Award until we get to Game of Thrones and all that. But anyway, that was a very good Mark. That was a very good thing that you said, and you gave a good presentation of that. I'm going to turn it over to our man from Houston, Kyler Smith. What have you got to ask, Mark Sargent?
Well, I was watching that thing on and I'd love to go, you know, dig deeper into the season thing too, because I watched that same video and it was hard for me to kind of catch on what he was saying. There's a lot of details that were throwing me off. But for now, my question was, how does digging work? Because I feel like we would hit some sort of bottom or hole. You know what I mean? Like there. So I'm curious.
I have never, by the way, no one's ever phrased it that way. In the 8 years I've been doing this, no one has ever actually used the word digging, but I love it. So you got a point there, which is eventually you'd think that somebody would run into a problem. And you're absolutely right. The deepest hole ever drilled, by the way, is I think 7.5, 7.3 miles. It might even be 7.8 miles. That's it.
Jesus.
And the Russians and the Germans tried for years, and they could not get past this barrier. The bits just started turning into slag, and they weren't expecting it. It's like, what, you know, it's like, well, there shouldn't be that sort of magma or heat at that level, but that's what they ran into, and so that was it. So the deepest hole ever drilled. Which begs the question, which I talked about in the original clues that I made back in 2015. I said, all right, so if that's the case, and it's supposedly 4,000 miles to the center of the Earth, if you believe the globe model, then what's the cross-section stuff we've been seeing since we've been, you know, children? You know, where you have those perfect 1,000-mile thick bands where it goes red, then orange, then yellow, and then a white milky center type thing, white hot center. And it's like if the deepest hole ever drilled barely even cracks, you know, half that distance is 2,000 miles, then you got 1,000 miles, 110, no, not even 10 miles. So how are you showing us the cross-section of the Earth? How do you know what's down there? And if you actually go into Wiki and look it up, this you can see in the fine print, which they used to put in the textbooks. Like, yeah, we have no idea what's down there. Absolutely no idea. We're extrapolating from volcanoes. But then they took that fine print out. It's like because they don't – science doesn't like questions. And, I mean, my argument is like, yes, I know it's embarrassing to just show the Earth with a giant question mark inside of it because science doesn't like to do that. It's like our best guess is this. Which means it's this. That's the one of the things I hate about science, which is when they change something, when they're completely wrong, then they just say, oh, well, the new truth is this. It's like, we're not going to apologize for what we said before because that was our best guess. Our new best guess is this. It's like, really? So that's what you're going to put in the textbook. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what?
Right.
And I totally agree with you with the whole science thing, like them just coming up with something. Yes, this is it. And I think this is just my point of view. Like, I really wish they wouldn't incentivize scientists for coming up with new things or something like that someone else has never found, because that really, really torments you actually looking for true facts. It just, like, then you get the idea of like, okay, I need to find something to get paid. So it's like it completely throws your starting point completely off.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You want to look up fun stuff that scientists have been working on forever and getting paid huge amounts of money and grants.
Yeah.
Look up gravitational waves, which they've been hunting for forever. Or, I mean, I have met physicists that spend their entire careers looking for dark matter. And if you don't know what dark matter is the missing piece, giant piece in the space puzzle, which they can't figure out. 90-something percent of the universe doesn't make sense. There's something happening out there that they don't know. So they came up with this catch-all magic thing called dark matter. It's like, well, the rest of it's just dark matter. It's like, do you know what it is? Well, no. Do you know how to detect it? No.
Mark, hold on a second. Here's what I want to do. Yeah. I want to direct all the scientists on exactly how to answer that question. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. I asked them to call me, and I will put them in touch with Robin Haynes McCrae, who is one of the best remote viewers in the world. And I'll say, Robin, they want to pay you about $50,000 to remote view dark matter and describe it to them. And they'd all be better off if they'd do that. I mean, she'd probably look at it and say, well, it's this, 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 and this. And then they'd have some clues, and then they'd probably solve their problems. So I think the best thing to do is hire a remote viewer. And that's what I do. And listen, whenever I have a question about a close friend, and I've done this many times, I will call one of my remote viewing friends, and they will tell me the answer to my question. And, you know, thank God they do, because, you know, when you have a friend that's sick, and then you can call them up and tell them with some certainty, you're really okay, and you probably just need to do this. And I'm not, you know, I'm not an MD. I mean, they know I'm not, but they'll do it. It's like, John, a week later, John, I feel so much better. And I don't say where I got my knowledge, you know. So, I mean, they just need to find a good remote viewer, call Joe McMonagle at the Monroe Institute, or call Robin Haynes McCrae at ScaryCast. We'll set them right. I'm sorry. I'm talking tongue-in-cheek, but not necessarily, okay? Please continue, kind sir. I couldn't miss that opportunity for one of my bad dad jokes, okay? You there?
Whose turn is it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, are we done with Skylar's answer?
Let's cut it there. Sure.
Okay, now, the senior inventor of ScaryCast, Dr. Brad Mulder, your question for the esteemed Mark Sargent.
Okay, well, this is the one question that really got me considering the flat Earth theory, or, you know, the idea that we're in an enclosure. These repeated experiments concerning gases, the way I understand it, the only way that you can a gas has to be confined by a barrier. If it's not confined by a barrier, it disperses. Okay? Now, that right there is what makes me go, because, you know, we're being told with the globe, the way I understand it, I may be totally wrong here, that the ionosphere or what have you is keeping our atmosphere entrapped, that the weight of oxygen, the weight of nitrogen is the reason why, and the gravitational pull of the Earth is what keeps our atmosphere intact and keeps it from just dispersing out into the vacuum of space. What is your opinion of this, kind sir? Oh, great one.
Oh, great one. appreciate that. When it comes to the gases, now, did you want me to comment on how the gases react to a vacuum, react to space, the density of gases, anything specific?
I mean, there's so many different ways of going about this, but okay, what is the typical common idea as to why gases are stay close to the Earth, why we have an atmosphere?
The answer to not just gases but a number of problems is gravity, which we talked about earlier, which is just a theory, right? That gravity is the only answer they can give especially when it comes to gases, which is why is our atmosphere still here? And if you guys have heard me do this before, the thought experiment is this. You're sitting wherever you are, and you have a vacuum chamber in the floor above you. And a vacuum chamber, if you guys don't know what a vacuum is, the listeners, that means there's nothing in there. And you know it's tough to visualize because there's no difference between a vacuum chamber and where you're sitting right now. Although what you're breathing in right now is, it's 80% nitrogen and 20% oxygen. Forget about the trace gases. We'll just go 80-20 for now. But a vacuum chamber has nothing in it, right? And the pressure difference is absolutely immense. I'll give you a quick example of a pressure difference. You blow up a balloon with your lips. You let it go. What happens? It just flies around the room because the pressure is trying to equalize. All right? So if there's a vacuum chamber above you, what do you think happens when you pop that valve? The air in your room is going to rush up there. And I'm not talking the slow way like you see in science fiction movies, right? Where it's like, oh, there's a hole over there, venting into space. We've only got 2 minutes of air left. No, it's instant. It's extremely violent. It's catastrophic. Ask anybody who deals with deep sea pressure stuff, oil rigs, submarines, stuff like that. It is amazing. The accidents we've had over the years are not for the faint of heart. They're awful. So the air would equalize absolutely instantly, rush upstairs instantly. And equalize, because pressure is one of the laws of thermodynamics. It is not a guideline. It is not a rule. It is a law. It absolutely will happen. So if that's the case, when you go outside, why is our atmosphere still here? Meaning, what's the difference, right? And I've even had people say, well, it's gravity. I go, you mean the same gravity that could not keep the air in your room from rushing upstairs? That same gravity is holding down everything, clouds, everything that flies. It's holding it to the Earth in a relative position because of gravity. I even had a physicist once almost said, he was like, well, because there's, he was going to say more gravity. I was like, really, more gravity? there's extra special gravity outside your house? No. In fact, I
like that answer.
I have yet to find a scientist who will answer this question. It's like, tell me what happens when our atmosphere ends and space begins. Tell me what happens there. And I even had a woman physicist from what country was she from? France. She said, well, it's just trailing off. It's barely tickling the vacuum of space. I go, that's not how it works. I go, the force of a vacuum does not care about it. It doesn't discriminate. It's almost like, you know, it's going to go after. I'll give you a quick little thought thing there, which is you take a cardboard box, right, and you put some packing popcorn in it, and you put little tiny little pieces of tape on the bottom. Pick up that box. What happens? Packing popcorn's fine. Everything's good. Good. Put the box back down. Put a whole bunch of books in there on top of the packing popcorn. Try to pick up that box again. What's going to happen? That box is just going to collapse. You know, everything's going to fly through because the book's going to push the packing popcorn. That's what would happen with our atmosphere. It wouldn't go off just the trailing. It would go off of everything that wasn't nailed down, including the oceans, because they're pressurized to a certain degree. They would just rip it all off. And so the science can only – in fact, it's a circular argument because they say, well, it has to be gravity because if it wasn't, we'd all be dead. And I go, that's your option. That's your – you're only – what you're committing to is you're saying it has to be because it cannot be anything else. I go, unless it's, of course, a pressurized system. In fact, it's called air pressure for a reason. And you guys came up with the term. I didn't. Or you'll throw one more, and I'll end this segment with this, which is it's – you know, doesn't the term greenhouse gases make more sense if it's an actual greenhouse instead of this – fictional thing where it's like, oh no, there's this layer of gas sitting next to space that's holding everything in. It's like, really? Not a physical structure. It's a layer of gas. Well, no, a physical structure, that's ridiculous. Because NASA proved that you know, you can go to the moon. It's like, oh, you mean the American military. Got it. Because they're completely above board. They're absolutely transparent. Sorry, I ramble. Next.
Okay, that was a great question. All right, I will come up with mine. And then we're going to go into open discussion. But I will say thank you very much to Transamerica Life Insurance Corporation for keeping us on the air. Without them, we would not be here. If you need any, if you have any questions about life insurance or annuities, call me, Dr. John Stamey. My number is 843-655-8775. And thank you to our guest, Mark Sargent, for being here and all of our scary casters. All right, Mark, I've got a question. I saw this funny thing on that site we discussed a little earlier, and it mirrored something that I had. You folks might have remembered this from a previous thing. It said, "How can the president talk in real time to the astronauts on up in the moon when it takes, and that's a quarter million miles away, when it takes in 2017, there was an 11-second delay talking to the people in the International Space Station at 250 miles. Mark, explain that, because I think, well, you know what I like about the flat Earth is it's inexorably tied to the moon exploration, and that's what I like about it, because I have kind of a chip on my shoulder. Is that okay? I have a chip on my shoulder about the moon. And so, I mean, you know, here's the deal. Me and my dad are sitting there watching watching them talk to mission control from the moon, Neil Armstrong. And I looked at my dad. I said, "Dad, I mean, that's a quarter of a million miles away." Everybody at that moment, everybody knew the moon was a quarter of a million miles away. I said, "That's a quarter of a million miles away. And you did communication in World War II. Wouldn't it take some time for each of those conversations to go back and forth?" And he looked at me, his eyes got wide shut, and he said, "Son, you're right. It takes time from a quarter of a million miles away. It takes maybe 15, 20 seconds." And that's what he said. And that was my dad, and I love my dad. So please comment on that. That's been my eternal question.
Sure. I'm going to probably wind up on this one. Because, okay, so where do I start? NASA is – all right, you know what? Let me get the disclaimers out of the way. I love America. I'm American as apple pie and baseball, even though baseball is just a form of cricket, but whatever. I'm American as a monster truck rally in NASCAR. How's that? And – I love this country. I do. But we, you know, there's a reason why the Russia and the Soviet Union before them called us the empire of lies. We are really good at pretending, at creating a show. You know, we're not the greatest empire in the world, in my opinion. Rome, the Roman Empire, was probably had more influence, but wow, does the United States put on a great show. And most of it is just smoke and mirrors, and NASA is that. NASA is absolutely, from beginning to end, just a stage show. That's all it's ever been. And I get it. I understand why they did it, and but in – for us, you know, like if you watch Fox News, there's one of the commentators on there is Dana Perino. I remember a couple of years ago they asked her, you know, because she was commenting on people that don't believe in the moon missions, don't believe in Apollo. And she goes, one of the scariest things I've ever heard on television. She goes, yeah, you remember she was a press secretary for the Bushes back in the day. She said, I believe in the moon missions because I'm a patriot. It's like, okay. Translation, if you know what's good for you, if you're an American, you believe in the moon missions. However, when you go to other countries, when I, because I've talked to groups in different countries before, and it's like, okay, I ask them, like, you people from Sweden, why do you think the Americans went to the moon? I know why all the Americans think that. It's, you know, we get out little American flags and we wave them, and, you know, a tear, you know, rolls down our cheek and turns into a bald eagle and flies away. Right, it's a wonderful thing. But why? Why do you people in Sweden believe the Americans went to the moon? And they all have, and it doesn't matter if it's Sweden or any other country, they all say the same thing. It's like, well, because it was on television. And the American media would never lie about something like that. And it's like, I don't know if I you guys are giving us way too much credit. So when it comes to the Apollo missions, the transmissions between President Nixon, you know, talking to him in real time, you know, they were piping it through his phone, you know, that's just a routing issue, and they could have done that back in the late 60s. But the transmission time was absolutely ridiculous, because not just that, but the fact that the astronauts, well, okay, one, that the government could even pinpoint where the astronaut communications were, you know, with analog, you know, back in 1969. But not only that, you can look up, you know, look up the images from Apollo, you know, that big, wonderful satellite dishy thing. Oh, yeah, it looked wonderful and all that. But remember, that thing was running off of a car battery. It's not like they had a big generator powered up that they could crank this thing up. It was running off of it. This was a VHF transmitter. It wasn't even classified. It had a range maybe of 50 miles. And that was Morse code. I mean, this thing shouldn't be able to beam. And yet this thing was doing perfect two-way communications and 10 frames of color video a second simultaneously, bouncing off a geo stationary capsule that was above them, and that thing was routing back to Earth, punching through the Van Allen belt, this huge massive static radiation donut that's supposedly, you know, surrounding the Earth, and it's absolutely flawless. No, there was way too many things with Apollo. So no, the communication thing was absolutely a nightmare. But let me throw this one more in there, which is the big thing for me, which they got away with, was the spacesuit, which is, remember I was talking about the vacuum versus, you know, a pressurized thing. You put anything in a vacuum chamber, it will expand until it just explodes, whether it be a volleyball or a football or a can of soda or whatever it is. The only object ever to not even show a symptom of this is the spacesuit. And I get it. Somebody brilliant came up with this idea, which is, you know, imagine sitting in a big meeting, and it's like, well, you know, we can't use the soft suit because, you know, the everyone knows it'll just turn into a parade float, it'll tip over and they'll die. And it's like, yeah, but nobody knows that. The physics clubs are tiny. You ever been to like a physics club? It's just a whole, you know, like a handful of nerds. Any school knows this. Right? No one's going to – and those nerds are going to watch, and it's like, well, they must have figured out a way to solve it, even though they never explained it. Tell me what's in that backpack. I don't care about cooling and oxygen and communications and all that. Tell me how – what's in that the backpack of the spacesuit that counteracts the force of a vacuum. But tell me how that happens. And sorry, one more thing. And I know we're pressed for time in the long run, but I got to get
it. You know what, Mark? We are not going to be pressed for time because this is the most enjoyable conversation we've ever had with you. So take whatever you need.
Okay, do you know? Do you guys know anybody that scuba dives, or do you scuba dive? Anybody here and listening?
I don't think so.
No.
Nobody knows any scuba divers? All right, whatever. Okay, so it's scuba divers, they'll tell you exactly one thing. That's all right. It's fine. Which is the only thing they care about when they're down there. The only thing they care about is their oxygen gauge, which is basically a little clock. And it's huge and it's brightly colored, and they're always looking at it constantly. Constantly, how many minutes of air left? How many minutes of air left? Because at some point, remember, you've got to head back up. You do not want to be caught down there, with right out of air. You know what I found one of the most interesting things about the Apollo programs, all of the Apollo programs? There isn't any audio of an astronaut checking his oxygen levels, ever. It's like at one point you would think when they're off in the distance, it's like, I only got 14 minutes of air left. Yeah, you better start heading back, that sort of thing. Never, ever happened. They had this unlimited air supply that nobody wants to talk about. And I don't care what sort of CO2 scrubbers you think you have. I mean, even if you could get away with it now, 1969, with analog technology, what do you got back then? Oh, just so frustrating. So frustrating. Anyway, so short version, NASA sucks. There you go. That's what I got.
Yeah, and I will add to that. In 1969, they did not have the technology to guide a space capsule back from the moon to within a one square mile area. They did not have it because that would take a supercomputer. We can do that today, but we could not do that then. And I mean, as a computer scientist, as a serious computer scientist, we did not have the technology. We were in 1969. We were using punch cards. Come on, I mean, it just didn't happen. And I'll go on record saying that. They can say whatever they want. Thank God IBM did whatever they could. And what's great is that a lot of people say there was this one little lady, and she was able to compute everything, and she just did it, and it worked. No, it didn't work like that. Just did not work like that. So what I'm saying is there are too many problems with this, but everybody wants to ignore them. And God knows if Hollywood made a real movie about this, they would all be shut down, I believe.
Yeah, they have avoided – Hollywood avoided making a moon movie for a long, long time. Long, long time. When I made The Clues, as a matter of fact, the closest we ever got was The Right Stuff, back from the 80s, which was basically the astronaut recruiting program for Apollo. But it ended – with a low Earth orbit launch, and that was it. And they never made a sequel to it, and it was amazing. And then decades later, they did, I think it was called First Man, where and they really downplayed, because it was the 50th anniversary of Armstrong's thingy, and they, it was made in Canada, used a Canadian actor, and it got like no publicity at all. And again, the old tricks are the best tricks. You think that they've updated since then? They haven't. So there's photographers out there, which is why I bring it up now, which say, well, you couldn't see stars in any of the Apollo shots because of exposure settings, right? All you had to do was change exposure settings. So, okay, fine. Even though we all know there's stars all the time, right? Tons and tons of stars. However, when Artemis, the new moon program that they're slowly but, dragging through the ground and this thing is never going anywhere, the Artemis 1 supposedly went around the moon and back, right? Hundreds of hours of footage compiled by multiple cameras, HD cameras. I will say this, the future, we have been robbed from a lot of things, but not cameras. Never in any of that footage you see stars from any angle, anywhere. And it's like, and so I throw that back at photographers. So it's like, okay, so what's your excuse now? Because it's all digital now. It's not exposure settings, right? It's not lens and film. It's all digital. You can do anything you want with cameras. There's so many different filters we can set on those things. And you're telling me with all those hundreds of hours, you're not going to show stars? There's no stars in space? I know why. Because to this day, they don't want to get the star formations wrong. Which is the Belt of Orion. Remember, everything's time and date stamped. the Belt of Orion better be exactly where it should be, and that means the entire sky, and they just don't want to do it. They're too lazy, or they figure the public is too accepting, so they're not going to do it. So there you go.
Okay. All right. That's great. All right. So here's what I'd like to do. I would like for everyone to do a one-minute Q&A with Mark. Is that okay? We're going to get your juices flowing, and we'll do a one-minute Q&A, and then we're going to say thank you, Mark, for being here with us. You have given so much great information, and this is something for the ages. I really appreciate it. So we're going to go in reverse order. Dr. Brad Mulder, what's your one-minute question for Mark Sargent?
Well, this is a good one, I hope. Today I had a conversation with John Stamey concerning how the planets orbit around the sun. Well, that's what I understand. I may be totally wrong about this. We don't orbit around the sun. We're not like going around the equator of the sun. What we're doing, we're basically supposedly following the sun as it makes its way through the galaxy, Milky Way galaxy, and we're like the tail of a comet. We're just following it, and on top of that, the orbit looks like a giant corkscrew.
Yeah.
And with that said, how in the heck can Polaris be in the same location every day of the year? What the heck's going on here? This does not make any sense to me. I don't care. I've looked at this thing sideways, up and down, left and right. What the heck's going on, my friend?
Yep. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And what you're talking about there is lack of parallax. And for those of you who don't know what parallax is, it's when you're driving down the road real fast and the mailboxes are zooming by real quickly, but off in the distance, the mountains are moving by really, really slowly because the mailboxes are much closer than the mountains, right? That's parallax. Objects in the distance relative to you don't move as far. But all those objects in between the mailbox and the mountains, will move, right? Houses and then, more houses off in the distance. Well, if that's the case, as you know, according to science, there are stars. The closest star is, I think, 4 or 5 light years away. And then there's stars that are 10,000 or more light years away. Huge distances, between the two. And yet we never see any parallax scrolling at all that's happening. The star constellations don't move. And that scientists come, the distances are too great. I'm going, okay, but, as you mentioned, the solar system is supposedly flying sideways like a dinner plate through the galaxy or like a shotgun pattern at 500,000 miles an hour, right? That's every hour of every day. And our galaxy is supposedly going at a couple million miles an hour through the bigger universe. And that over time, I don't care if it's 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, eventually you're going to see some changes. And yet, when you go to, we'll just pick the zodiac, right? You compare our zodiac now to the zodiac the ancients drew a long time ago. They're still there, right? The crab's still there. The Pisces are still there. Everybody at Taurus is still there. Everything's still there. Still in the same place that it always was. And science will come back, well, no, it's moved. It's moved a tiny little bit, but it's moved. It's like, it should have moved a lot more than that, man. Come on, you're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of stars in different places in the galaxy, and we're not seeing any of it. We're not seeing any of the changes. So no, it's again, they put that information out there, and we just take it at face value because they are smarter than you. There you go.
Even though they're not, they're good at publicity.
Exactly.
I'll just say that.
They believe their own press. So go ahead.
So, all right, Dr. Brad Mulder, thank you for that minute question. Kyler Smith, do you have a one-minute question for Mark Sargent?
I do. Okay, so if power, if money, if social status was not an issue, who is the number one person you would love to pick their brain and interview and try to at least sit down in a room and talk with?
About this? Whoa. Or just somebody in general?
About, yeah. Well, everything we've been talking about tonight.
Well, if it comes to flat Earth, well, that's just it. And that is the first rule of power has never, ever changed over time. And the short answer is I don't know because we don't know who they are. The first rule of power is stay hidden. Napoleon, I think, said it best. Pretty quotable guy, all things considered. And he said the masses can't get you if they don't know who you are. I'm butchering that a little bit, but that's what he's basically saying. And that is when you're in the public eye, if you're a puppet, whether it be a president or a king or a dictator or whatever it is, you're in the public eye. They know who you are. You can be overthrown. Oh, that was the saying. He goes, never put yourself in a position where you can be overthrown, which is every leader that's currently out there. If the people of Britain wanted to lead a revolt to trash the palace, they absolutely could. But if they don't know who you are, there is no target. So what I'm saying is you can't be a puppet master and a puppet simultaneously. So the short answer to your question, I don't know, because the real puppet masters are absolutely behind the scenes and they're never going to come out because that's one of the rules, which is you can't come out. And I don't care, and don't give me the stuff about, oh, the richest men in the world. Anybody that says that certain people are the richest people in the world, that's public money. That's new money. Come on. Really, Bill Gates? It's like he's a mastermind. Not really. Yeah, he was a really rich guy, and everybody bought his product. Jeff Bezos, yeah, everybody has Amazon Prime. Elon Musk, total fraud. I could spend 2 hours just talking about him. But when it comes to other families, we're talking about families with bank accounts so large that it's meaningless to them, where, you know, it's 12 digits or more. So would I like to talk to one of these people? Sure. Would I know exactly what to ask them? No. If I had 10 questions, I suppose I could come up with something. If I only had one question, I've been wrestling with that. I don't know what I'd ask them to figure it out. Only that, you know, I probably wouldn't even ask me a question. I'd probably be like, take me to Antarctica. Show me something I've never seen before. That would be it. Show me something. Either that or the if that was an option, I'd say, okay, fine, show me the Dulce, New Mexico base, sub-basements. Show me the hallway of horrors. Look that up if you get a chance. That always intrigued me. So there you go.
Wow. Yeah, that's a pretty good answer.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that one. Chris Chastain, your one-minute question for Mark Sargent.
All right, one-minute question, and then I'm going to do a 10-second statement. I don't know if any of you are fans of the cartoon Family Guy, but go out and look for Family Guy Moon Landing. It will make you laugh. It goes right along with what we were just talking about.
I've seen it. It's good.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Okay, real quick question. You mentioned before the dome and the snow globe, and I've seen some pictures on graphics online. What exactly do you think, what is the dome? Is this just figurative, or do you think it's actually made of, it's an actual physical thing going over us?
Well, I do think it's a physical thing that's going over us. However, do I think it's dome shaped because of how the star trails and everything in the sky looks like it's going over a curved surface? Possibly, unless we're talking about a rear projection system that is using some really, really godlike software. Meaning, real quick, the when we build simulations, and we'll just use the entertainment world, like Minecraft or Fortnite or GTA or Warcraft or whatever it is, it's all squared off. There is no dome, right? Even though the sky, everything moves in the sky like there is a dome, it's called a skybox system because computers only deal with right angles. Computers don't know how to deal with spheres. They can only create illusions of spheres and circles. So do I think there's an actual dome above us? Yeah, but I could go either way. You know, it could also be a squared off system that's simulating a dome. Just because our planetariums, the reason why our planetariums use domes for ceilings is because it's easier. And because remember, planetariums have been around, for decades and decades. But now if you wanted to build a brand new planetarium, if you had the money, they wouldn't use a dome. If you had unlimited funds, you'd just use a completely squared off box, just a big boxy building, and then you'd simulate the star trails using software. So,
cool beans.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, oh, sorry, one more thing, which is let me throw this one more thing, if it is an actual physical dome, if it is not virtual or some sort of projection system that's squared off, then what could it be made out of? I mean, do I think it's physical at that point? Sure. At that point, it could be, again, a heavy element, a heavy water, a unified field, a force field, some sort of electrostatic barrier. I don't know. At that point, it's really dealer's choice.
Gotcha.
There you go.
Okie dokie.
Well, thank you.
Mark, thanks very much. This is Dr. John. And I wanted to ask you the last question. It sounds like a movie or something, right? Mm-hmm. I like to deal with the number four. And so would you come back for a Monday night scary cast when we get Robin McCray back and finish this great series that we've got? Because I think it's been – this is legendary. I mean, nobody's really gone into the depths that we have. So can I count on you for just one more, and it'll be a Monday night scary cast with Dr. Trey Dunaway, Robin McCray, Chris Chastain, and me? Can we do that?
I don't think so. Sure.
Why not? Great. I don't think
I love
so.
It.
Oh, my God. That's terrible. But anyway, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun. It really has been. And wanted to say thank you for being here with us. And everybody say goodbye now.
Bye, guys.
Goodbye.
Bye now.
Goodbye, everybody. Take care.
Adios.
Thanks, guys.
Mark, that was good.